the CMU podcast in association with Seven Digital.
This week, dissecting the digital dollar, the Fanfare Alliance, and some other news. It's the CMU podcast, probably quite echoey from not our usual studio this week, because we're not in our usual studio this week. We're in an echoey office, and there's a police helicopter circling, so that's good. But don't write in. We'll be back to normal next week.
It'll all be fine. We warned people last week that this was going to happen, so people have had a whole week to prepare. So that's all sorted. People won't mind. We'll remind you the reason why we are not in our usual studio in Shoreditch for this edition of the podcast is, well, you said it in the intro, didn't you? We launched Dissecting the Digital Dollar this morning. And so this is sort of a special edition of the podcast. A, because we're going to talk about that. B, because we've got a guest.
Yeah.
That's quite exciting. But because there's lots of stuff going on today, rather than recording in our studio, we are recording at the Talyard Studios, which actually is probably has more recording studios than any other bit of London. But I didn't arrange to use one of those. I arranged to use a random room because I sort of forgot to organise it and I arranged it last night. But that's all fine. And the fact that the helicopter has arrived just as we've started recording, having been quite quiet up until now, it's all sorted.
It's atmospheric.
It is atmospheric.
Yes.
And we'll fix it in the edit.
So my guests, who insist on speaking before I've introduced them...
You're Andy Malt. Have you even said that?
I said that, and then I was going to introduce you like a professional, and you cut in, and there's, you know, there's, everything's going so wrong, we can't even start again now.
He's CMU editor Andy Malt.
You're Chris Cook.
I am.
No one cares what you do. And we also have Annabella Coldrick.
Hello.
From the MMF.
That being the Music Managers Forum.
Who have just published Dissecting the Digital Dollar, Part 2,
and it's very exciting and jam-packed full of information about how streaming services are licensed and what we want to do to make the music industry a better place for artists and fans.
So we're doing a different sort of podcast today. So rather than us discussing what's been happening, what did you say last week? Dissecting and analysing and something. So rather than looking at big music business stories that have happened over the last 7 days, we will have a very quick run at the end of the podcast through the big music business stories of the last week. But we're going to spend most of this edition talking about, well, first of all, the Dissecting Digital Dollar. Andy is going to interview me because, of course, it's the MMF's report. We, as in CMU, as in CMU Insights, have produced it. So I wrote it. So I'm actually properly here as a guest today, rather than that being a running gag on the podcast. So for the first part, Andy's going to interview myself and Annabella about the report. Then, because we've got Annabella in the room, we're going to talk about the Fanfare Alliance, which is another big project that MMF has been behind. And then at the end, we'll do something almost like the normal podcast. So I'm looking forward to being interviewed by CMU's Andy Malt about Dissecting Digital Dollar Part 2.
So Part 1 was a look at how digital services are licensed and how the money flows through the system. What's Part 2?
What is Part 2? So Part 1 came out almost exactly a year ago. That wasn't arranged. It just turned out that way. It's almost exactly...
It was arranged that it came out last year.
Yes, but the fact that a year to the day almost Part 2 is coming out. So as you say, Part 1 set out to explain how streaming services of the sort of Spotify, Apple Music variety are licensed. It's a bit mad the way streaming services are licensed. And so in order to understand how a Spotify is licensed, you need to know a little bit of copyright law. You need to know a little bit about record contracts and publishing contracts. You need to know a little bit about collective licensing and the rules of collective licensing. And so Part 1 explains all of that. Explains how a streaming service is licensed, explains how the digital dollars work their way through the system. And then at the back of that, there were 7 issues. So having researched all of that, we came up with 7 issues that we felt needed to be addressed a year ago. And I suppose the aim of the report from the MMF's perspective was to educate managers about how streaming is working so that they can better advise their artists, but also to instigate a debate. And so Part 2 is basically reporting back on that debate. So the MMF organised, we did a lot of roundtables, didn't we? A lot of sessions.
I think we did 12, something like 12 roundtables in at least 4 different countries.
And so that brought together people from across the music industry. Obviously, about 200 people took part total. And more managers than anything else, because that was the purpose. But we didn't just have managers. So we got representatives of record labels involved, and of music publishers, and we had some artists and songwriters in there as well.
And lawyers and accountants.
And some lawyers and accountants, because it's always good to hear from the lawyers and accountants. And some of the sessions were just one group of people, so artists and songwriters, lawyers and accountants, managers. And then we had other sessions where we had everybody at the table. And so we did a lot here in the UK, but we wanted to have a bit of an international perspective. So we did two in the US, one in Canada, and one in France, so to get a North American viewpoint and a continental European viewpoint. And so these roundtables took place. We went through seven different topics at each of those meetings. And then basically part two is a summary of what was said and the themes and the issues and the views that came out of that. And then from an MMF's perspective, there are some recommendations in the report and in sort of the executive summary up front, MMF is setting out its agenda, basically.
Yeah, so it's the kind of so what. So we've explored all the issues, we understand potentially what the challenges are with streaming, and then what are we actually going to do about it? And that's where we come in.
And what are you going to do about it?
Well, there are three main areas we've identified for action. We've got various actions that we feel that the MMF and that managers need to do. So a lot of that is around educating managers about how streaming operates, what the questions are, understanding the different deals that are on the market. This idea that you can drive change through innovation, and actually managers and artists can be an agent in driving that change through the competition in the marketplace. So there's a whole series of actions that we need to take on board. There's then some actions for the wider industry. So we will call upon the industry to help transform the way it operates, to make it operate in a fairer and more transparent way. And then the kind of last section is, well, there's only so much potentially that can be done in a voluntary way by the industry as a whole. And then it's, what is the backstop role for governments and regulation to help create that level playing field and ensure that the marketplace operates in a fair and transparent way?
So what were the topics that you covered?
Well, as I said, we covered seven topics in every single one of the roundtables in 2 hours. So it's a little bit like this podcast. We ran through things incredibly fast. But let's see if I can remember what the seven topics were. And most of the report is structured around each of these themes. So first of all, we talked about the division of revenue, which was a big theme of part one. So the way streaming works, Spotify and Apple Music, it's ultimately a revenue share model. So unlike in the sort of CD download era, where the record companies would set a rate, they would tell the retailer what they wanted to charge for the record or the download. I mean, actually with downloads, sometimes Apple set the rate, but each sale had a rate and then that money was shared up. Whereas streaming is more complicated than that. And part one explains all of that in great detail. But each month, the streaming services hand over a big chunk of money to the music industry at large. They ultimately aim to keep about 30% of the revenue. So a Spotify and Apple Music in the ideal world will keep about 30% of the money that comes in from subscriptions, mainly a little bit of advertising income as well. Actually, at the moment, that isn't even happening because there are a whole load of minimum guarantees put into the deal as well. So every time a track streams, the service is obliged to pay the record industry and the music publishers a minimum fee per stream. And as a result of that, at the end of the month, once they've paid all the minimum guarantees, they're keeping, well, by Spotify's figures last year, probably about 13, maybe up to 15% of the money, rather than the 30% which they are aiming to keep. However, let's say we get to the revenue share stage. Ultimately, that's how it's going to work once the minimum guarantees fall away and the services reach a scale where actually rev share outperforms minimum guarantees. And what will happen then is that they'll hand over about 70% of their income over to the music industry every month. And then the question is, well, what happens to that money once it comes into the music industry? There are some people in the artist community, some people in sort of the music industry who have said that the streaming services should hand over more money. They shouldn't keep 30% of the money. Well, A, they're not even keeping 30% of the money, but eventually they will. Having said that, the vast, vast majority of the people taking part in all these roundtables that we did didn't agree with that position. Most people felt that the services ultimately aiming to keep about 30% of the income seemed fair. There is a parallel there in that that's sort of similar to what the record shop used to keep when CDs were sold. So it's not suddenly you've got to share a third of your income that you didn't used to. So in the main, there wasn't a feeling amongst the people we were talking to that the streaming services should get less. So therefore, the big question is, well, what happens to the money that comes in to the industry? How does that 70% get divvied up? And what happens is a big chunk of the money goes over to the record companies. A much smaller chunk of the money then goes to the music publishers and the collecting societies. And then those two organisations then have to share it on the one side with artists and the other side with songwriters. So as it currently stands, the label earns the most, then probably the artist next, although obviously that is totally reliant on the artist's contract with the label, because what the label then shares with the artist will be set out in record contract, and then the songwriters and the publishers are getting a smaller chunk of money. So the first debate was, is it fair the way the money is currently split up? Perhaps unsurprisingly, most of the representatives of record companies felt that it was fair and everybody else thought that it wasn't.
And it's partly because it's following the sales model, isn't it? It's taking the model of a physical sale that was then a download that's now a stream. And so this is why I think for the labels, they said, well, we're just following on the model that we've always had. They've not considered streaming in any way as a new format or an opportunity to look at how the money might be shared.
I think that's true of the publishers as well. When they were negotiating this in the first place, they went, oh, we'll carry on with the same percentage we had before. That seems fine. And then it was only 5 years later they went, hang on.
There's not enough money flowing through to songwriters, yeah.
And record companies, when defending the status quo, will say a couple of things. And one thing is, in essence, what you've just said. It's just the same as CDs. It's the same as downloads. Surely that's fine. Actually, what they probably would then say as an aside to that is, actually, the publishing side is getting slightly more on a stream than they did on a download, and they got slightly more on a download than they did on a CD. And artists, I mean, again, what artists receive is totally reliant on record contracts, but you know, a lot of labels are paying a slightly higher royalty on a stream than they did on a download than they did on a CD. So the labels would say, well, it's basically the model we had previously, but actually the publishers are already seeing slightly more, the artists are already seeing slightly more, and then they would say, we continue to be the big risk takers in new music. It's expensive producing new music. The labels put up the money, they pay for the studio time, they distribute the content, they do the marketing. So we are the risk takers, so we need to have the majority of the money, if and when it works, in order to justify that investment. So that's the label's position. Coming from the other side, the managers, the songwriters, the artists, the publishers, what they were generally saying was, they didn't necessarily disagree that labels are still the primary investors in new music. In the main, the people saying, yeah, we agree, you are still the primary investors in new music. However, we don't think that the risks you are taking in the streaming era are as significant as the risks you were taking in the CD era. So they are still the big risk taker. They probably should be getting the biggest slice of what we call the digital pie, but not as big a slice as they are currently getting. And I think on the publishing songwriter side, the general consensus was, we accept we're getting slightly more than we used to. Artists would say, perhaps, depending on our record contract, we're getting slightly more than we used to. But actually, we feel that your risks are sufficiently lower in the streaming age that it shouldn't be we're getting slightly more, like a few percent more. Actually, there should be more significant rebalancing. Not necessarily saying the label shouldn't be getting the biggest slice, but that the slice shouldn't be quite as big as it currently is. And so that was very much the sort of the viewpoint that came across all the roundtables, the labels defending their current position, the songwriters, the publishers, the managers, the artists not being completely convinced by that argument that actually, well, one thing the labels were saying is our costs are as high as they ever were. Even though we're not manufacturing CDs and we're not distributing, that was never as big a part of the budget as most people think it was. And actually, it's all about studio time and marketing, and those costs are as high as they ever were. In the main, the other people weren't totally convinced by that argument. And therefore, there was a consensus that there should be a bit of a rebalancing of the way the money is distributed. The next question, which then brings us on to the second of the topics, we're still on the first.
Oh, God.
But division of revenue was by far the biggest, wasn't it?
It was. It was definitely the biggest.
At all the round tables, it was like often the first hour was on that topic.
Yeah.
Because the question is, okay, if the majority of the people in the room, but not the labels, think that there should be a rebalancing, how is that even achieved? Because the way the streaming deals work is that the labels go and do their deals with the streaming services. Well, actually, it's the other way around. The streaming services go and do their deals with the labels and commit to give a certain amount of their revenue to the labels. Then they go and do their deals with the publishers and the songwriters. But by that point, they've already given up probably 58% of their revenue to the labels. So they can't be too generous to the publishers. And then in terms of how the artists get paid, well, that's reliant on record contracts. And in many cases, obviously, for new artists, the contract will explicitly say what the streaming income is. But for older artists, it's how do you interpret contracts that don't mention streams in the streaming age? So how do we achieve rebalancing? And that brings us on to the second topic, which is performer equitable remuneration, We won't go into that in any great detail here now because it gets very complicated very quickly, but you can go and read it in the report, which is available for free online. But that would be a way of assuring performers, which actually includes the session musicians as well as the featured artists, because as it currently stands, the session musicians get nothing from streaming income unless they happen to be on a contractual share, but it's unlikely that they will be. It would be it would set a statutory minimum so that the law would say that of the streaming income, a certain amount of the money, now the question is,
what? How much? Yeah.
What certain amount? It could be a tiny, it could be a more significant, but a certain amount of the money would be a set industry standard rate that would be shared between the featured artists and the session musicians, and that would come probably through a collecting society like PPL, so that the artists would get a certain minimum automatically, and then what then happens to the money that goes to the label and how that's shared, that's the subject to contract. That's for the label and the artist.
Yeah, and this isn't kind of inventing a new model. Obviously, it's potentially related to the model that's paid on traditional radio and that's then paid on online radio, has equitable remuneration applied to it. So there is a precedent. In fact, in Spain and in Hungary, the courts there have interpreted ER, as we call it, to apply to all streaming, not just the non-interactive radio, but all streaming. And actually, I think in the days of playlisting, where someone else is curating that content, there's an even stronger argument that you should potentially be looking at a different model when you look at streaming.
So yes, if we were to apply equitable remuneration to streams across the board, and when I say we, when the industry could decide to do that, or if the industry doesn't voluntarily decide to do that, it might be, as has happened in some other European countries, that a court or government says, no, there should be some equitable remuneration. And yeah, it's not a brand new concept. It's basically applying what already happens in radio, already happens in public performance, happens with online radio, and in some countries, some personalized or a Pandora type service, it would be applying that to streaming. Now, making that work is quite complicated because it totally depends on local copyright law. So every country, the approach would be slightly different. In theory, across the European Union, there should be some sort of harmonization, but A, on ER, it doesn't always work. Plus, of course, here in the UK, what the hell does that mean? We've no idea. But the consensus was amongst the managers that even though introducing equitable remuneration on streaming would be a complicated route to go, it's something that should definitely be considered, because without it, do we think we can rebalance the digital income in the way we've described? A lot of managers were thinking probably not, and therefore it's definitely something that we should look into at this stage, even if it would be quite complicated to achieve.
Well, and this is also looking a bit into the future, isn't it? So at the moment, many artists, particularly those on pre-digital contracts that are subject to a whole range of deductions and discounts, as we've been exploring, are potentially not seeing anything from streaming because they haven't recouped on their advance that they were paid in 1992. So the only income they're often seeing from their music at the moment is that comes through the collecting societies. And if you look 10, 20 years in the future, where potentially we've all got interactive radio in our cars, we're all on 3G, then potentially that income diminishes entirely. And
yes.
So this is about not just thinking about now, but kind of 10, 15 years out. And we often have the argument back, well, actually, the payouts from PPL are going up and up and up. And that's true, and it's fantastic. But further ahead, looking at how this is structured and technological advances, I think it's worth considering, and we would argue it's definitely worth considering how ER might be applied.
Yes, because although the music industry's income from radio has continued to grow, all the research suggests, particularly younger consumers, on not listening to traditional radio. So you have to think at some point that is going to peak and it's going to start to go down. So that was topic two.
Okay, 3 to 7, that's how quickly can you get through those?
Oh, we can get through these really quickly. Are you ready to get through these really quickly?
Yeah, go.
Number three was sharing the value of digital deals. So that is to say, to date, we've been talking about what happens to the money that is handed over from the streaming services to the music industry every month based on how many subscribers there are and how many streams there are. In addition to that, many of the record companies have received advances from the services. They've received equity in the services. They often charge fees to the services on first deal. And so the question was, well, what happens to the other value in those deals beyond the monthly money that comes in? Now, in the last year or so, and we've talked about this on the podcast, many labels have made some commitments on this already. So that's great. The indies through the World Independent Network have their Fair Deals Declaration, and some of the majors too have put out specific statements about certain other elements of the deal and that they're committing to share it with their artists. So on this, there was an element of the managers we were speaking to saying, that's brilliant, we recognise that, we welcome that, but, and there was a but, and the but was, it's not really clear how these commitments are going to be delivered.
Exactly that. And that's one of the things in the report that we're looking to see is indeed if and when at some point there is some money that's realised there in terms of equity, how exactly will it be paid through? What will the terms be? And what we would like is for the labels to declare clear public policies about how that money will be paid so artists can have confidence and trust that it's being paid through correctly.
And that brings us actually to the topic where, certainly from a management perspective, there seem to be the biggest issues, which is transparency. And time and again through all of this, what a lot of managers were saying, and even on the division of the revenue, there's a lot of unknowns around the streaming deals. And again, we've talked about this on the podcast before. So you can be signed to a label. The label is then controlling your music. They're monetizing that music with the streaming services. The money is flowing in every month or every quarter, however long they pay. They share that with you. They give you a royalty statement. They say, you earned this from Spotify. You earned this from Apple Music. Well, that's great. But then if you say, well, how did you work out what I was due? Okay, what did Spotify pay you? How did Spotify work out what they owed you? Were there any deductions and discounts on what you pay me? I'm on a 20% split, but some things might happen according to our contract before. And this is where there's a lot of transparency issues that artists and managers are often in the dark about a lot of this. Some of it is they are deliberately in the dark because when they go to the labels to ask, they are told, sorry, we can't share this information with you for various reasons. Other times you sense actually sometimes it's just communication issues that because everyone has sort of shifted over to this new model and we're all still learning, labels are spitting out these royalty statements every month. But really, there needs to be everyone sitting down and saying, okay, what does this mean? What does that mean? And rather than every single artist and every single manager going to every single label saying, what does this mean? What does this mean? And sort of educating the community and sort of getting some sort of awareness of exactly how these things work. And I think most of the managers taking part, if they had to pick one of these issues to say is the single biggest issue, it is the transparency issue. The fact there's so much secrecy around the deals. And so things like division of revenue, if some managers would say, well, we have opinions on this, but we can't have our final opinion on how the money is shared because we don't understand the way the deals are structured. We don't understand what happens to the money as it flows through the system because there's all of these secrets and unknowns. And we need that information to be able to have a final decision on what is or isn't fair in terms of how the money is split between the stakeholders.
I think it's worth saying, I think the labels have made great steps and advances in terms of sharing more information with their artists than before, and I've certainly gone in and looked at some of the different portals. A lot of the time they're sharing information on, you know, where the streams are, information on location and frequency, and there's a lot of data that's coming through that's often separate from the royalty data. And then when you see the royalty data, even if it's done line by line through a portal, you see the name of the track, you see how many times it's streamed, and you see an amount. You're not quite sure how they got to that amount. So this is the thing. There are great steps forwards being taken by the labels. However, we're still unable to do that tracing. And we know that some labels, this is something that's been said to us, particularly on the indie side, have been willing to show what that payment is that they've received from Spotify or Apple or Deezer or whoever, and have shown that to the managers and artists, and they've kind of gone, okay, fine, that looks like we're being paid a fair share based on contract. When you can't see that at all, and all you're seeing is lots and lots of lines and no idea about how that calculation has been broken down, it's not surprising that people are saying, well, how do we understand how streaming benefits us? And the other thing maybe to say is that when artists do self-release and they see 100% of the money coming through, they're often a lot more happy and a lot more pro-streaming, perhaps, than those particularly on legacy contracts where after all the deductions and discounts, they're seeing maybe 2% of every pound paid to a label.
And from a manager's perspective, the reason why managers are asking for this transparency, for asking for access to information, well, part of it is simply to audit that information. One of the jobs of a manager is to help their artists audit royalties to check they're getting all the money they are due. Obviously, an accountant is often involved in that process as well, but it's really hard to properly audit streaming income. And we mentioned we had accountants at the round tables, and they were very hands in the air. So it's like, yeah, whenever I audit my artist's money on streaming, I reach a point in the audit where I just can't go any further because I'm missing this valuable information about the deals. But beyond that, there's also the issue that managers have to advise artists on which business partners to work with, which labels, which distributors, which label services companies, which publishers, which collecting societies. And it's really hard to do that when it comes to streaming if you can't see exactly what the label, the distributor, the publisher, the collecting society is doing when they monetize the content. And then perhaps most importantly of all, which was sort of what I sort of led with when we did the launch earlier today, is where we're currently at with recorded music is that we know streaming is the future. Streaming is the now. Streaming is where all the growth is. And actually where the real growth is in premium streaming, paid for streaming. That's why the record industry went back into growth last year. So what the music community at large needs is as many people as possible to sign up to those paid for streaming services. And everybody needs that. The labels need it, the publishers need it, the artists need it, the songwriters need it, the managers need it. That is the end game. But the problem is that is basically asking artists to encourage their fans to stop buying CDs and to stop downloading and to start paying for a Spotify or an Apple Music or whatever. And most artists, not all artists, because there are some artists who are yet to be convinced about the Spotify model at all. I think most artists recognize, yeah, that's the future. That's the future of my business. But I, or at the very least my manager, we understand the CD business. We understand the download business. There's all these questions about the streaming. So you're asking me to push all of my fans over to a business model that we don't understand. So if only the artists and songwriters and managers could have access to that information, then we can all agree as one. Yes, these are the services that are driving the growth. These are the services that are good for artists. And we can all try and persuade as many consumers as we can to sign up to the £10 a month services and then work on the £5 a month services and then ultimately work out what free streaming is going to look like. So I think that is sort of why the transparency point is the most important point. Just very quickly, we also talked about data. We've talked about data before. We talked about safe harbors. We've talked about that a lot on the podcast, so much. And we talked about collective licensing and the role of the collecting societies. And actually, with all of those, transparency also comes up in, you know, should we go the collective licensing route? Well, there's transparency issues of collective licensing too, so it's hard to know. On safe harbors, you know, should artists and managers and songwriters be getting behind the labels and the publishers' campaign to get reform of safe harbors, to get more money out of, say, a YouTube-type service? Well, they probably should, but we don't understand that business because we can't compare it to this business. So actually, there's a transparency element to that story too. So of all the things we talked about, I think transparency was the biggest, although there are other things too. And in terms of the action points that you were mentioning, where it's managers changing the way they do stuff, I mean, when it comes to data, some of that is the onus is on managers to get their head around what data their artists should be providing and making sure that they do it.
And that's absolutely essential, because otherwise the money doesn't flow through correctly and you find out that there are pools of money sitting there which haven't been paid out because the data is incorrect, because someone hasn't had the time, they've been so busy doing other things, they haven't gone in and checked that data as correct with the collecting societies.
Yeah, we could fix everything else. We could get a happier balance of the money. We could get more transparency. But if artists aren't ensuring that when they put out a new recording, all that information is logged in all the relevant databases, if songwriters aren't doing the same, then the money might be coming in, it might be being divvied up in a fair way, there might be transparency, but it won't be getting to the bank accounts of the artists.
Yeah, exactly that. And there are all these exciting new data initiatives, some led by CMOs and by private sector companies, blockchain we hear a lot about. But again, it's got to be correct, whichever one of those becomes
yes,
the future.
Yes, the data's no good
to
start
with. It
still
has to be correct, yeah.
So I think that's sort of a summary of what's
yes,
in there.
Yes, I think that's a fair summary.
And the full report, like part one, is quite long, but we go through each of those in...
Full report is 99 pages, Chris.
99 pages. And we go through each of those in detail, and we explain what managers said. We explain what the labels and the publishers said. You know, I think it's important to put the other sides of the argument and to consider them. And actually, you know, in many cases, well, artists might say, well, we would rather go the collective licensing route. And actually, often they do. Labels will say, oh, there's issues of collective licensing around recordings. And managers will say, yeah, we agree. We acknowledge that there are issues with collective licensing around recording. So all the sort of different viewpoints are put there. And then there are some different options. We might go this route, we might go this route. And then up front in the executive summary, which if you don't like reading long reports, you can just download the exec summary in there. Then that's where you, from an MMF perspective, would be much more specific in saying, this is the way forward, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, and as we said, under three areas, what we, the MMF, will do and what managers need to do, what's our role, because it's not just the rest of the industry that needs to tackle these issues, it's all of us. Where we do think there are actions from labels, publishers, CMOs, DSPs, we name what we think those actions are. And as we say, where there has been progress, we think we've got a role to champion and celebrate that. And then kind of the final bit is looking at, well, as in the US, with the, there are various court cases, as we said, there have been in other European countries, what are potentially the regulatory levers? And at the moment, I think you've talked about it before on your podcast, we have a new European copyright directive. Who knows if it will apply in UK law? Actually, I think potentially it will do, because the Great Repeal Bill seems to suggest that everything that's in EU law at the time we Brexit will be transposed into UK law. So that's got quite interesting provisions in it in terms of transparency, maybe not strong enough, but it does try and tackle the issues with transparency on a regulatory basis that would apply across all EU 28, at least for a while. It also has an interesting clause around legacy contracts, where a creative product, whether that be a film or music or whatever, goes on to become much more successful than initially envisaged. It gives a legal basis to reopen that. Again, we're not quite sure about how that would work in practice, but there's also provisions in there for alternative dispute resolution, which I think is potentially really important for artists and managers, because being able to, willing to take an entire court case through, often it doesn't happen because of cost or it's settled at an early stage. So
hence our constant line on the podcast, this probably won't get to court.
Indeed.
Because generally artists can't afford to get to court.
Yeah, the M&M challenge, and there's another challenge, isn't there, going on at the moment. So there are some really interesting provisions in there. We've done some quite interesting economic modelling about how equitable remuneration could operate and what the different benefits would be of different systems. We need to do more work around that. And in some ways, we need to engage more directly with the UK government as well to have those discussions with them about actually what could we change in UK law. And as we say, we do back the industry-wide campaign on safe harbours, but we think it's absolutely and intrinsically linked to the whole issue of transparency throughout the value chain. It's not just about getting more money to move from DSPs to rights holders. It needs to be that confidence that the money comes all the way through.
So if you go to the MMF's website or the CMU Insights website, either or, you can access the PDF versions of both the executive summary and the full report. Obviously, you're going to read the full report on the train home tonight. That's the plan.
Yeah. So well, the executive summary.
Well, I think full report.
Well, I haven't got a printed copy of the full report.
That's because there aren't any yet. There will be printed summaries of it at some point. But also, we're going on a little bit of a mini tour, aren't we, Chris?
We are.
So if you're listening, you might be able to come and see us somewhere.
We will be presenting this with slides.
With slides.
If you like visuals. We're still negotiating the Wembley date. But if you're in France, the MAMA festival / convention is coming up. So if you're not familiar with MAMA, it's a little bit like The Great Escape, but it's sort of the French one of those in Paris. It's happening next week. And in amongst the Thursday proceedings around about lunchtime, myself and Annabella, basically what we did in London this morning, if you weren't there, you can go and see it there. So if you're at the MAMA convention, then you can come and hear us talk about it.
Yeah, or if you're listening in the US, do you have listeners in the US?
Well, we have lots of listeners in the US.
I'm sure you have many. Then John Webster, who's our president, and Johnny will be touring the US. They're going to New York, Nashville and LA next week. So the details through the MMF. So they'll be going, they'll be presenting the same thing, an opportunity to get your hands on a copy.
I've got a feeling that they got the better side of that.
Yeah, we get one day in Paris, they get an entire US tour.
Yeah. So next time we'll have to switch
next
that.
Next time, Chris.
And they can go to France. And we'll do the North American
trip. That sounds like a plan.
So go read Dissecting the Digital Dollar, part 2.
Coming up later in the podcast, Chris and I will be chatting through some of the news stories that have happened in the music industry this week, as we normally do. But now, as Annabella is here, and we've talked about the Fanfare Alliance on the podcast before.
Very recently.
Very recently.
Yeah. Summer recap edition, we had a whole discussion of this, the latest attempt to finally try and do something about secondary ticketing.
Yeah, but you've heard us trying to
ramble on about it.
But now somebody who's actually involved in it is here. I thought we'd ask Annabella, what is it and how can you get involved?
What is it? So, as Chris said, I think there was a lot of cynicism in the industry that issues around secondary ticketing or industrial ticket touting we've been talking about. People have tried to tackle them before. There wasn't really the political will. They didn't feel like the industry as a whole really got to grips with it. However, back in January or February this year, a bunch of managers got together along with other players in the industry who thought, actually, this is not only a problem, but it's a problem that's getting worse and there's an opportunity to do something about it. The government had commissioned a review by economics professor Waterson
from the University of Warwick, and it felt actually here we've got an opportunity to tackle this at a political level, potentially at an industry level, and also we know consumers are getting more and more frustrated because industrial touting has just soared. So there was always, as we always said, the guys outside the venue, but actually those guys outside the venue and many others are now online buying large scale numbers of tickets with no intention to go to the gig. So we're saying, okay, so what can we actually do about it? And it's being a bit practical. How do we help consumers understand what the challenges are and how, if they want to buy tickets directly from artists, they can do so? So that's one of the aims of Fanfare, is that kind of consumer engagement. Every time there's a story about secondary ticketing in the press, it's like, okay, so where do consumers go to get information about how to avoid it? Second area is about the industry itself. So government, particularly the previous government, was very hands off in terms of regulation. They said, we want the industry to sort itself out. So we've been looking actually, again, what can we do to sort ourselves out? And so it was earlier on in September, we hosted a big live and ticketing summit. We got together about 130 managers, promoters, agents and others to talk about what can we as an industry do, what technology can we use, what tips and techniques are there, such as names on tickets. And we produce something called the Manager's Guide, the Touts Out Manager's Guide.
Because certain artists have been trying, haven't they? Obviously, Adele.
Certain artists have, yeah.
I've tried it. And Glastonbury for years have been putting all these different. So I suppose it's interesting, of all these different tactics people have tried, names on tickets, photo ID, tying it to the credit card, pre-ordering with a really careful database.
Yeah.
Which of those are working and which of them should other people be doing?
So it's about sharing that knowledge and expertise so that managers don't get to the stage where, you know, the gigs have gone on tour. People on Twitter, the fans are having a go at the artist and they're saying, oh, I've got no idea what to do. Well, actually, here's a guide. Here's what some of the things you can do. It won't stop ticket touting entirely, but at least it will help minimise it. So that was kind of the second area. And the third area is around government regulation again. So we've done all of this. What is the role of government and regulation? So Professor Waterston has put forward his report and he said the first thing we need to do is enforce the law. Because the four main secondary ticketing platforms at the moment say they are just a platform. So whilst the Consumer Rights Act came into force last year and it said you have to declare the seat and row number of the ticket, there's other legislation that says you have to declare if you're a professional trader. So if you sell stuff on eBay, you have to say whether you're doing it on a professional basis or whether it's just me trying to flog my old enemies to the occasional person on my old toys, you have to declare that. But the secondary ticketing platforms have said, no, it's not us. We're not buying and selling. It's someone, it's Joe Bloggs in Scotland, and it's up to Joe Bloggs to declare what the seat numbers are, and it's up to Joe Bloggs to declare whether or not he's a professional trader. So they don't do that.
Yeah, so it's all well and good. I mean, we've talked about the podcast before. So the Consumer Rights Act, for the first time, introduced a little bit of relatively light regulation, but there is now some regulation in the law. And of course, as we've also talked about in the podcast before, when it comes to touting football tickets, actually that's illegal. You're not allowed to do it. And yet no one enforces those laws. So if laws aren't enforced, they might as well not be
there. Well, that's the thing. It's a really big issue for sport as well. And actually, quite interestingly, training standards have finally started getting involved. And last week there was a story, not to do with music, but to do with cricket tickets, where Viagogo was listing tickets for cricket matches that haven't been issued. You know, they're not even for sale. They've not been announced. And they put out a statement saying, this is illegal and it should not happen. So the challenge is to enforce the law. I think trading standards have, you know, seen cuts, as have most areas of the British public services over the last few years. But Waterston says we need to put some money in, see the law enforced. At the same time, the Competition and Markets Authority is doing an inquiry into undertakings by the four sites. So there's quite a lot of political will. Nigel Adams MP, who is chair of the music APPG in Parliament, he's got very behind the campaign. He's put out an article recently explaining his own frustrations trying to buy Green Day tickets for his kids. And I've just been up at the Conservative Party conference actually talking to him and some other MPs about what can be done on a political level. Because actually it's quite a cross-party issue and it does feel that there may be some opportunities to help change things. But
and
it's
do
not...
you think, obviously, the big story from the Conservative Party conference was, obviously, we have a new government that sort of came out of nowhere.
An unelected far-right government.
Do you think with our mad new government, there is still a sort of... Because, obviously, that report that you mentioned came under Cameron's government. Is there still a will to make this happen?
Well, this is where it's interesting, because whilst the report came out of Cameron's government, the previous Secretary of State, Sajid Javid, was very free market, very Thatcherite.
under Theresa May, we hear supposedly a desire to get more involved in taking large companies to task, a bit more corporate social responsibility, and that there is maybe a positive role for government. So we hope that will be better received.
So in amongst all of that nonsense, actually, there might be something good about this.
Well, we hope so. And we also think, you know, as we're dissecting the digital dollar, the more you raise the pressure and the debates about this, it encourages people to get engaged and it encourages companies to look at their practices. And really interestingly, Ticketmaster, which of course also owns secondary sites.
And which is Live Nation.
Has been making some moves recently with Biffy Clyro gigs and with the Iron Maiden gigs to give commitments to artists and managers that they will ensure that their tickets, which go through their primary site, will not appear on their secondary sites if they put certain provisions in place. So we've said that's great, that's really good. We still have a problem with the way secondary operates more generally. However, where you're doing that, we think that's great. We'd like to see that happen for all managers and artists, not just those with the biggest negotiating power. So this is, you know, where we've got a role in trying to lift the level of how the industry operates in this space. So there's definitely some progress on the industry sorting itself out a bit. I know StubHub in some occasions have refused to list tickets themselves where there's been a really clear view from the artists and management that they do not want those tickets to appear on secondary. We've not yet seen any progress whatsoever with Viagogo. They are based in Switzerland, after all. They don't comment, they don't get involved. So that's a bigger challenge. But I think, you know, let's sort out what we can do. And also let's inform consumers and fans how they can try and get the tickets firsthand for artists and how maybe not putting them all on sale at 9 a.m. on a Friday, but there are other ways to do it that enable you to reach the fans, not all in one go, but over time to try and limit touting.
And I should say, it is interesting. I mean, throughout, although, as you mentioned, there was a culture minister on the Tory side who was very much the touts. They're just, you know,
classic entrepreneurs.
That was what he said. Classic entrepreneurs. Yeah, but having said that, it is, I mean, the people in Parliament who managed to sneak in that regulation in the Consumer Rights Act, because it wasn't in the original draft from government, but it was added in Parliament. And there was both a Conservative MP and a Labour MP who did
Sharon
that
Hodgson.
Together.
And they've been fantastic. And then we got Lord Clement Jones, who's on the Lib Dem side. Actually, it's a real cross-party issue and something that we hope we can help form that consensus around if we've got those champions in Parliament. But it's not all regulation. It's partly getting the regulatory framework right, getting the industry to get its act together, and then also getting fans to know how and where they can buy from
and,
their artists.
And also, I suppose, where you started, which is a lot of managers and agents and promoters, people across, you know, the live side. We had all these conversations 10 years ago. It didn't really go the way that the anti-tout people wanted. And so almost you sort of got to the point where a lot of managers, promoters and agents were just like, oh, for God's sake, well, let's just live with it. So also, so one of the messages is, no, we're gonna do something this time. And so if you are a promoter or an agent or manager who did sort of give up on this, now's the time to be aware again and help with all these
different
processes.
Yeah, and it feels that that's happening, but we still want more people to sign the Fanfare Declaration. You can go onto the fanfarealliance.org website, see the declaration, sign up to the campaign. We've had lots of fans telling us their stories about their difficulties and challenges in accessing tickets, which we're able to feed into government. We're doing more research, but it's an opportunity to actually try and do something positive, because if we don't, actually, the problem has only got worse and worse. So it feels like now's the time.
And those US listeners that we spoke about, follow the lead.
Well, yeah, and actually in the US it's potentially even a bigger challenge, but there are some things happening over there with in New York,
there's
I think
some
with
state
the Attorney
law, isn't
General
there? Yeah,
yeah, and some states I think it's banned, secondary ticketing is banned on a state basis. However, StubHub is an enormous business over there. The secondary market does extremely well. But again, it's one of those issues that's starting to gain traction, and we've seen artists taking a stand. Chance the Rapper, I think, has done some kind of amazing thing, buying all the tickets up. So anyway, we've got to prove we can. In fact, in France, they've already banned it. So they've taken action in France, some other European countries. We're trying to prove we can make a difference in the UK. And then, yeah, next stop, let's try and see how we can help change attitudes in the US as well.
And of course, Japan are having
it. Japan has a very similar campaign. It's called Resale No, I think, although obviously in Japanese.
You would hope so. So perhaps we could get you sent out on a, you know, given that we're not getting the North American gig.
Investigatory tour of Japan.
Yeah, get you over to Tokyo. I think Andy would come if it involved a trip.
I'll carry a bag.
You could report on it.
Yeah.
You could report on it.
Okay.
And see some Japanese bands at the same time.
Yeah.
Always something I enjoy doing.
We just need to work out who's paying for this trip. But we'll get to the bottom of that. But so good to have a good update.
Yeah.
On the
thank you very much for inviting
Alliance.
Me to join your podcast.
Yes. And thank you for talking about both the big projects that have been going on at the moment.
And I've got to run because we've got to go and do a presentation down the road in 20 minutes.
So our wrap-up of the big stories of the week is going to be an incredibly fast wrap-up so that I can leave this little echoey room in Talyard and go over to Camden, where we're doing the, so this morning was sort of the launch to journalists and to trade bodies, and then actually the management community are amassing this evening and we're going to do another launch. So we better play that jingle and do the last bit of the podcast super fast.
Well, we've obviously focused on other things. We focused on the launch of the Dissecting the Digital Dollar Part 2 report and the Fanfare Alliance, but we should run through a bit of this week's music industry news.
That is our remit.
That is our remit. That's what you've tuned in for, so that's what you're going to get.
So let's very quickly go through the top five music business stories of the week. We reckon we can do that in the few minutes that we have left. The fake shake is guilty.
Not strictly music industry news, although it was Tulisa Kontostavlos who brought him down.
Exactly. So I'm not even sure we've talked about this on the podcast. I think it fell in the downtime. So the fake shake, real name Maza Mahmood. He is an ex-News of the World journalist. He was at News of the World for a long time. Then, of course, News of the World got shut down. He moved over to The Sun on Sunday once it was launched. And he's an investigative journalist who is famous for basically doing sort of sting operations where he...
Fake shake being the classic one where he pretended to be a sheikh who was going to give people lots of money to do something corrupt.
Exactly. And then he gets the celebrity admitting to something, so they're going to exploit their position in power to his advantage, or they're going to get him some drugs or do something else illegal.
Yes. Other than the fake sheikh, his other classic is gaining the trust of a celebrity by telling them that they were going to get something they really wanted that they weren't actually going to get, and then getting them to buy him drugs. In the case of Tulisa, she thought she was going to get a big film contract, and in a bid to keep the wheels rolling on that, agreed to get him some drugs. It all went to court, but then the court case fell apart when it turned out that, he tampered with the evidence, basically.
Yes. So, I mean, the story ran in The Sun on Sunday, and then Tulisa was arrested, and it was a criminal case.
Yes.
So she was facing, criminal charges, potentially, a bit of jail time.
And this has happened to a lot of
other celebs
who he's...
And somehow, the fact that most celebrities, if you really need them to, can get you access to some cocaine is still news all these years on. And so that was the sting. The story ran. Tulisa went to court facing criminal charges, but the entire case fell to pieces because of the allegation as it was then. And this week in court, it was said, yes, this happened, that basically his driver, who'd worked with him for a very long time, when giving his statement to the police as part of the criminal investigation, if the allegations against Tulisa, had said, oh, there was that one time when Tulisa was in the back of the car and she was talking about how she had lots of problems with sort of hard drugs, and that she had, I think it was a
not
relation.
Problems herself. I mean, she just didn't like.
Yeah. Not problems as in as a user. Yes, problems as in issues with the use of those drugs, because she had a family member who had struggled with drug addiction, and so she was very much on, oh no, you shouldn't have recreational use of those drugs. And then subsequently, the driver said to the police, actually, I'm not sure if I remembered that right. Can you take it out of my witness statement? And so the allegation was that the fake sheikh had discovered that this had gone into the police statement, felt that damaged the case against Tulisa. Tulisa's defence being that it was a setup, it was entrapment.
And of course, for him, the big finale to any of his stings is the celebrity going down.
So the allegation was that he persuaded his driver to change his statement, and then there was sort of inconsistencies in what Mahmood actually said in court about this. The whole case fell apart. The judge basically said, you're not a credible witness. So the case fell down. Tulisa, who'd been very critical about his tactics and the fact that this was basically entrapment, was very pleased with that. But then he was then arrested himself for tampering with evidence, basically perverting the course of justice. And that all went to court last month. And then earlier this week, he was found guilty.
And as was his driver.
As was his driver. Yet to be sentenced. So the sentencing is later this month, but
a lot of civil action coming.
Exactly, out. Beyond any.
Was it the £800 million worth of damages?
So,
which I assume he doesn't have.
There is a lawyer who represents a lot of celebrities who says, well, when we reported it was 18, I think there's been some more added since we ran that report. So a number of celebrities who have been victims of Mahmood's stings over the years, because now his tactics have been exposed in court, feel that there may be a case for civil action. Yeah, and this lawyer was saying if he added up all the potential damages they would be suing for, it was more money than could possibly be available to be had. I mean, I don't know if they will also sue the newspaper. Who knows? But anyway.
Even then. But yes, yeah. We'll see.
Technically a media story, media law, but because ultimately he was brought down through the misbehaviour in the Chiliza case, it sort of counts as music news. Moving on, definitely music news, or clubbing news, I suppose. The latest developments in the whole Fabric license debacle.
Yes, Fabric. Well, this is part of Fabric because they're raising all this money to help with their legal costs, and they managed to raise over £250,000 in 2 weeks. They've committed to release every 2 weeks, they're releasing a transparency statement, which basically tells you how much money they've got and what they've done with that money, and also what the progress with their case.
So obviously this is attempting to overturn the licensing ruling last month. Islington Council revoked their license because of those drug-related deaths earlier in the year, and so they're now going through the process of appealing that through the courts.
Yes, and so they've just released their second transparency statement, which revealed that they have secured a licensing hearing at Highbury Magistrates Court on the 28th of November. I mean, the aim of that hearing is to overrule Islington Council's revocation of the license and get the club open again, which will mean they've got some money coming in. Well, one, it will mean the club's open again, but it will also mean they've got some money coming in to help fund what is going to be very expensive
yes,
proceedings.
The full wider appeal. Plus, in addition to all the legal stuff, they are also committing to lobby government in terms of the way the guidelines are written for the enforcement of the Licensing Act by local councils. They believe that there are some weaknesses in that guidance, which results in bad decisions being made in planning meetings of councils. So in addition to actual the legal action on a specific case, they're also doing the lobbying, and that's already underway as well, isn't it? That was
yes,
part of
yes.
the update.
Sony ATV is now fully owned by Sony Corp.
So this has been a long-running story, but obviously Sony ATV, the biggest music publisher in the world, until last week, was half owned by Sony Corp, hence the Sony bit in the name, and half owned by the Michael Jackson estate, not hence the ATV bit in the name, although it is, because ATV was a separate company. Michael Jackson bought it in the 80s, merged it with Sony's music publishing company in the 90s, and then they had a very successful joint venture for a long period of time. After Michael Jackson's death, the estate continued to be the business partner. But then last year, we found out that talks were underway for Sony to buy the estate out of the business, which they did. But obviously that deal was announced earlier this year, but it had to go before the regulator. The European Commission green-lighted the deal earlier this summer, and so the news this week was that the deal had now taken place. $750 million has moved from Sony's bank account to the Michael Jackson estate's bank account, and Sony ATV is now a wholly owned subsidiary of Sony Corp.
Though the Michael Jackson estate does still have a stake in EMI.
It's true. Slightly complicated ownership of EMI Music Publishing, which day-to-day operates as if it's a division of Sony ATV. But when Sony led the acquisition of the old EMI Music Publishing company, they did not buy it alone. So the Michael Jackson estate was involved in that, but other people were as well. So the EMI Music Publishing company still has multiple shareholders, including the Michael Jackson estate. Although day-to-day, all of those rights are administered by Sony ATV, which is now wholly owned by Sony. So we never need to talk about that story ever again, which is good.
Prince's Paisley Park home is now going to be opened as a museum. In fact, it opened as a museum today as we're recording it on Thursday.
But only for 3 days.
Only for 3 days over the next eight. Basically over the summer, obviously Prince died over earlier this year. I'm sure you know that.
I remember.
Over the summer, it was announced that Paisley Park, which is his studio complex, has got a club in there. It's this huge, and where he lived, this huge building. It was going to be turned into a museum.
Announced by another estate, his estate.
His estate, yes. Arguably a little bit too quickly, because it was due to open this week. And on Monday, the local council considered a proposal to change the parking rules around the, because obviously it's a residential area, change the parking rules to accommodate this new museum.
So people could park.
But the council said, no, we need a bit more time to work out, you know, not just what the right sort of parking zone is, but like, you know, traffic safety, pedestrian safety, public safety in general for people who live there. So no, you can't open this Thursday. By Thursday morning, they'd have managed to negotiate.
Because they've sold a lot of tickets already.
Yeah. So they'd managed to negotiate a temporary permit to open. So they're opening. So they opened on Thursday as planned. It was then going to be open on the Saturday and the Friday of the following week. And after that, who knows? But that's, I mean, and those opening times are for people who've already bought tickets only. You can't buy new tickets currently. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a, I mean, people did say that's a little bit quickly to be opening it. And it's turned out to be a bit of a debacle. So, so fun times.
But hopefully they'll get it sorted and then eventually it will open full time permanently and it will be a little sort of a tribute to Prince that the fans can go and visit. But you might have to walk. might be the conclusion of all of that.
And now in some happy news to round up with. Robbie Williams is to be awarded the Robbie Williams Award for being Robbie Williams.
Because, of course, Robbie Williams is back.
Yes.
He's got a new album. He's back in the limelight. And what he needs is another Brit Award.
Yes.
Because he's only got more Brit Awards than anybody else.
Yes.
So he needs another one.
He has 17. He's getting an 18th.
So this is the Brit Icon Award.
Yeah, which was invented 3 years ago. 2013, Elton John was the first person to receive it for reasons that were never entirely clear.
But the crucial point to mention is then and now is this isn't an award presented at the Brit Awards in February. This is a standalone award with a standalone event.
Yes.
Which is a live event that's televised. And so it not only is it an award, it's an entire event built around Robbie, which is convenient with the new album to sell. And the same thing happened with Elton 3 years ago.
Yeah, so it was a bit like, so it's sort of, you know, they announced this Elton thing, and they're like, well, that's a bit weird, having a standalone event to give him a thing. And it's partly because they don't have the outstanding achievement or whatever it is, outstanding contribution
that they used to
award
have
at the Brits they used to have. But then having it as a standalone separate event is, I don't know, I suppose it's a thing where you can do an hour, well, 90 minutes in the case of Robbie, where you just celebrate one person. It's basically a televised Robbie gig with an award in it, I think. But then basically after 2013, it never happened again. We were like, well, that was weird. And then in January, David Bowie died. And obviously the Brits were like, well, we better do something for David Bowie. So they kind of wheeled it out again because they're, you know, as they don't have the Outstanding Contribution Award. So they're just like, oh, well, you know, we'll do a tribute and then he can have that award. In fact, I'd completely forgotten that he'd got it until I wrote this Robbie story this week. But then, yeah, now having not done it for 3 years, they're now going to do it twice in 2016.
So perhaps having brought it back out as a David Bowie tribute, perhaps Robbie was watching that at home and was like, I'd like one of those. I've got a new album out. And then they persuaded the Brits to resurrect the standalone event.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing. Not sponsored by MasterCard, as the Brits normally are.
And has been for a very long time.
Yes, because I think that deal is up for negotiation. It's in fact being sponsored by some coffee brand, which that's an interesting thing we could discuss, but we're not going to.
So assuming that you're not going to get invited or buy tickets to the actual show.
Tickets are really expensive.
Then worry not, ITV are filming it. And so you, at some point later in the year, you'll be able to sit down, have a cup of coffee.
Yes.
Support the sponsor. And you'll be able to watch Robbie Williams receive his. And I assume that he gets the award, he sings some songs, and then there's lots of those terribly tedious videos where you get celebrity friends saying, oh, I love Robbie, he's great, and that sort of stuff.
Yes, yes. So it's he's going to get the award at the beginning of November at the Troxy in London, and then in December, presumably in the run-up to Christmas or around Christmas time, that show is going to be broadcast on ITV, and everyone will be happy with their prizes and or money.
So that's something to look forward to. And that wraps up this podcast.
It does. If you want to listen to something with better audio quality.
We'll be back in the studio next week.
Well, there's that. But I was going to say, why not go and listen to one of our Spotify playlists? Where you can listen to all the new music we've covered in the CMU Daily this week. Or you can listen to all of the CMU approved tracks, or most of them, from this year.
And you're sure this week you didn't approve anything, a song, a recording, that as it happened was recorded in a little office and therefore is quite echoey?
No,
it's all
top quality recording that will be probably much more pleasant to your ears than this episode of the podcast has been. But well done for sticking with it this far.
Hey, if you think this was a little bit echoey and not sounding like it was recorded in a studio, let's all remember the edition last summer where I did it on a phone and it was a bit awful.
From a cupboard.
So, you know, it could be worse, is my message.
It could be worse. It could be worse. It could be the rest of everything that's happened this week.
It is, yeah. Put in the context of all the political events happening in the US and here in the UK, actually, a little bit of an echoey audio on the CME podcast is something I think we can all live with.
Yeah, yeah.
And hopefully worth it for finding out more about dissecting the digital dollar and the Fanfare Alliance from an insider.
We'll be back next week.
No guests.
No guests.
But in a studio.
Just me and him in our normal format. Me and him being Andy Malt and Chris Cook, respectively. For more on CMU, just go to completemusicupdate.com.